IndieCreekRadio.org.
Welcome to Indie Newswire, a weekly review of breaking news published on Independent Media Center newswires from all over the world. Today on the Indie Newswire, an interview with Catherine Redmond of the National Coalition Against Violent Athletes on the De Anza rape case, closed last week by California Attorney General Jerry Brown's office, citing lack of evidence. An extremely disturbing case and an even more disturbing response from the Santa Clara County DA and the state attorney general. More than a year later, Catherine Redmond will discuss this and other cases nationwide. Also, an update from Oaxaca Community Radio by Cactus from the Oaxaca Study Action Group. Migra Watch, a couple stories on local issues. Lakeside Organics, yes, local and organic, but labor exploitative. And a new sex abuse scandal and lawsuit. Detention centers are the new Indian schools. ICE equals Guantanamo. Eric McDavid was sentenced yesterday, news from InfoShop. And some stories from KBOO about a Pepsi shareholders meeting. A plane crash in Venezuela that looks like suspicious CIA activity, perhaps. And police brutality in Portland. We'll hear Democracy Now! At noon, followed by Earthbeat Radio. Then more indie media audio right up until Free Speech Radio News at 5, including Democracy Now! In Español, Frente Indígena Organizaciones Binacionales at UCSC from Indie Bay. There was a presentation up on campus. Women of Haifa from Radio for All. Brian Curry, an Iraq vet, talking about post-traumatic stress syndrome from Indie Bay and Courage to Resist. Plus Ursula K. Le Guin and Jill Friedberg from KBOO. But first, a story on the recent wave of SEAL shootings from Portland Indie Media.
We believe that this is completely illegal, what they've been doing in the first place. It goes against the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972 that should be protecting these sea lions from any kind of harassment or hazing or, in this case, from being killed. The whole purpose of the Marine Mammal Protection Act was to be able to get the California sea lion's numbers back up and the stellar sea lion numbers back up. And as soon as their numbers start to rebound, you see these permits being applied for to be able to kill them, which is exactly what happened recently. A judge in this area, Judge Mosman, originally ruled a few weeks ago that up to 85 sea lions could be shot and killed out here. And then a court in San Francisco overruled that judgment and just said that they could be trapped. And in this trapping, they are sending these sea lions off to SeaWorld and zoos, basically capturing wild animals and then sending them off to these show parks for humans to watch. The sea lions are getting blamed for the salmon recovery plans not being successful, but in fact, it's not the sea lions. It's obviously the dams.
Free Radio 101.1 from KBOO and the Portland Independent Media Center. That story was tagged as if it had something to do with the SEAL killings recently. So I'll read from the San Jose Mercury News, a story from Julia Prada-Sulik. The waves cleanse this remote stretch of coastline Monday where the tides have erased the blood of the three elephant seals and any footprints left when someone pointed a gun at the back of their heads and fired. State game wardens severed the seals' heads Sunday to retrieve bullets for evidence, then buried the carcasses they feared were too gruesome for the tourists lined up along the bluff to see. But the surf unearthed one of them, and the turkey vultures made a meal of it. It's a tough case to solve in this scenic windswept place on the beach that has no name. 5 miles north of Hearst Castle, 1 million motorists driving up and down Highway 1 each year pass by. Many of them make the turnoff to the parking lot at Elephant Seal Vista Point, where in almost any month of the year, thousands of warbling seals are lounging on the sand. Sometime last Friday night or early Saturday morning, when there is but a sliver of moon and barely a flicker from the Piedras Blancas lighthouse up the road, someone approached the elephant seals, not with a camera, but with a gun. The killings came a day before 6 sea lions were discovered dead. 700 miles away on the Columbia River, on the border of Oregon, Washington, someone apparently shot these seals. Authorities are investigating whether the two cases are connected. It appears doubtful, however, because the sea lions, which until 2 weeks earlier had been the subjects of limited legal hunting because they eat endangered salmon, were found in traps. These animals don't feed on fish here, and they were free, just laying on the beach, said State Park Ranger Bill Payne, who patrols the Elephant Seal Beach. You wonder what would drive a person to do it. There's got to be a lot of anger. Volunteer docents making their rounds at 9 a.m. Saturday discovered the blood soaking into the sand. Two seals, about 3 and 4 years old, were found dead next to each other. At about 1,000 pounds each, they were too heavy to roll over to determine whether they were male or female. The third was a 5-year-old male. Special Agent Roy Torres from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration traveled from his Monterey office to this little cove on Sunday, looking for clues. He wouldn't say what he found. It could prove to be a difficult investigation, he said. There are no neighbors to interview. The nearby Piedras Blancas Motel and Cappuccino Cove just up the highway have long been shuttered. The only witnesses may be the 3,000 elephant seals, mostly juveniles and yearlings born in January and February, lounging on the beach as if nothing happened. They're in molting season now, shedding their winter coats. The males jockey with each other, jawing like playful puppies. The females bark and yap and burrow into the sand. They watch their peeling fur with their flippers, scratch their peeling fur with their flippers, and swat sand onto their backs. Hundreds of tourists line the bluffs to watch them every day. A sign was posted along the fence line Monday. $5,000 reward, it said, for information that will lead to an arrest in the seal poaching. Whether the killer lives somewhere in the area or was just passing through is unknown. It's hard to know whether they jumped the fence after the docents had gone home at 4 p.m. Torres says he's hoping someone saw something and will call the tip line. Elephant seals are protected under the 1972 Marine Mammal Protection Act, which makes it illegal to harass, shoot, or feed them. Violating the law can result in fines up to $20,000 in jail time. Because the crime occurred in the Monterey National Marine Sanctuary, an extra $130,000 fine may apply. We would have hoped they would have been afforded some sanctuary. We would hope they would respect that, Torres said. Torres said that necropsies will be performed on the seal heads and the bullets will be extracted to get critical evidence. Ranger Payne, who patrols the Elephant Seal Beach, said the killings are hard on the rangers and volunteers. It's so rare, it's kind of shocking, Payne said. You've got to care about it because you care for the animals. You become very protective. On the San Jose Mercury News, someone out there is shooting elephant seals. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. And this is a relatively recent track from The Roots. It's called False Media, off their latest Game Theory. Stay tuned. This is the Indie News Wire.
Then we will weaken ourselves for what is really the issue. And then behind that all lies a very personal and human feeling that I don't think old men ought to promote wars for young men to fight.
America's lost somewhere inside of Littleton. 11 million children are on the Ritalin. That's why I don't need it for the sake of Ritalin. False media, we don't need it, do we? Pilgrim, slave, Indian, Mexican. It looks real fucked up for your Mexican. That's why I don't rhyme for the sake of Ritalin. False media.
If I can't work to make it, I'd rather take it. Either that or me and my children are starving and naked. Rather be a criminal pro than a follow the matrix. Hey, it's me, the monster, y'all done created. I've been inaugurated. Keep the bright lights out of our faces. You can't shake it, it ain't a way to swallow the hatred. Ain't fire, holla, by the dollar, nothing is sacred. We gon' pimp the shit out of nature. Send our troops to get my paper. Tell them stay away from them skyscrapers. Ain't long before you get y'all acres. I'ma show them who the global gangster. Sense me the FOMO, yeah, stank it. I'ma make you feel a little bit safer. Because it ain't over, see, that's how we get your fear to control you. But ain't nobody under more control than a soldier. And how could you expect a kid to keep his composure when all sorts of thoughts fall for exposure again?
America's lost somewhere inside of Littleton. 11 million children are on Ritalin. That's why I don't rhyme for the sake of Ritalin. False media, we don't need it, do we? Pilgrim, slave, engine. outside of Littleton. 11 million children are on Ritalin. That's why I don't rhyme for the sake of Ritalin. False media, we don't need it, do we? Pilled, enslaved, indigent, Mexican. It looks real fucked up for your Mexican. That's why I don't rhyme for the sake of Ritalin. False media, we don't need it, do we? America's lost somewhere inside of Littleton. 11 million children are on Ritalin. That's why I don't rhyme for the sake of Ritalin. False media, we don't need it, do we? False media, we don't need it, do we?
False media, we don't need it, do we? The Roots off of Game Theory. This is the Indie News Wire on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Comes to you every Friday from 10 a.m. to noon, right when we broadcast Democracy Now! For its noon, 12 noon redo. Eric McDavid got sentenced yesterday to 20 years. I'm reading from InfoShop News. Eric McDavid, the Forest Hill man portrayed as an eco-terrorist by the government and a kind and gentle soul by his lawyer and family, was sentenced Thursday in Sacramento Federal Court to 19 years and 7 months in prison. U.S. District Judge Morrison C. England Jr. found that McDavid's plan to, quote, disrupt government and commercial installations overrides his lack of a criminal history and a reputation among family and friends as a peaceful individual. This is posted by Denny Walsh, author of the story at the Sacramento Bee. Eric McDavid, the judge. Morrison England denied defense lawyer Mark Mitchell's request for bail pending appeal. He earlier told the judge, Mr. McDavid and I plan to pursue his appeal vigorously. McDavid, 30, was found guilty by a jury in September of conspiring with two others to damage and destroy by fire and an explosive, a federal facility. A grand jury indictment charged the three with targeting a U.S. Forest Service genetics lab in Placerville, the Nimbus Dam in a neighboring Fitch Hatchery in Rancho Cordova, and private facilities used in interstate commerce. Prosecutors sought the maximum 20-year sentence. His attorney asked for 5 years, Eric's attorney. Eric had never been before involved in any criminal behavior, said his defense attorney in a sentencing memorandum. Indeed, but for the actions of the FBI and the informant in the case, there is no evidence McDavid would ever have committed any crime at all. The testimony and evidence at trial established that, in fact, it was the informant who pushed on the target of a government facility. She, Anna, pushed the plans forward, undisputably. But prosecutors countered that McDavid needed no prodding to resort to acts of violence against what he perceives as symbols of the establishment's corruption of the environment. Quote, McDavid's homegrown brand of eco-terrorism is just as dangerous and insidious as international terrorism, prosecutors R. Stephen Laffram and Ellen Andreese said in their statement. A 20-year term of imprisonment demonstrates that the public does not tolerate those who would generate fear and inflict massive property damage in order to oppose government policy. McDavid has been in Sacramento County's downtown jail since January 13, 2006, the day he and two co-defendants, Jackery Jensen and Lauren Weiner, were arrested in a shopping center parking lot in Auburn. Jensen and Weiner, both 22, were allowed to plead guilty to lesser charges that carry a 5-year prison cap in return for their testimony against McDavid. Jackery Jensen is scheduled for sentencing August 7th. Lauren Weiner's is set for next Thursday. This comes from the Migra Watch website, MigraWatch.org. Children claim repeated sex abuse. 9 immigrant children were repeatedly sexually molested and beaten last year while housed in a government-operated youth detention center near San Antonio, Texas. Their cries for help were covered up by administrators and state and federal officials, according to a lawsuit filed a little ways back. Texas Sheltered Care in Nixon was among about 36 facilities across the country run by private firms under government contract to temporarily house unaccompanied immigrant minors caught trying to cross the border. The Nixon Center, 55 miles east of San Antonio, was shuttered nearly a year ago after allegations of sexual abuse first surfaced. An investigation initiated by the FBI, but later punted to the Gonzales County Sheriff's Department, resulted in the prosecution and conviction of a guard, Belinda Leal, who was sentenced in September to 7 years in prison. But the children, all Central Americans, and their advocates now say in a lawsuit filed in federal court in San Antonio that the maltreatment was much graver than Leal's actions. It accuses two other guards of sexual and physical cruelty and says they engaged in a cover-up with their bosses and state and federal officials. These children are the most vulnerable and easily exploitable immigrants, said Jose Garza, a lawyer for Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid in San Antonio who is leading the case. The government has shown a complete disregard for their safety and well-being, and that's shameful. The lawsuit alleges several of the children, identified only by their initials, were repeatedly fondled by Leo while others were forced to grope her and perform oral sex on her. The suit accused two other guards, one identified as Efrain Garcia, the other unnamed, of beating the minors. On one occasion, according to the suit, Garcia, in a drunken rage, attacked a boy, throwing him against a wall and door. The suit cites a 16-year-old Honduran as the whistleblower in the case. After rejecting Leal's sexual advances, the boy reported her to the center's top administrators, the suit says. But instead of supporting him, the administrators retaliated. He was transferred to a more restrictive youth center after attempting suicide while his deportation case played out in immigration court. The lawsuit claims officials of the Department of Health and Human Services, which is in charge of all the shelters, then decided to transfer him out of state as punishment and to cover up the problem. Upon his return, they and other government officials arranged to lock him up in the Guadalupe County Jail, the suit alleges, before finally transferring him to the Abraxas Hector Garza Center in San Antonio, which HHS, Health and Human Services, quietly opened in August as a restrictive center. The city is host to another center for minor immigrant detainees on the west side, run by Baptist Child and Family Services. Reading from the MigraWatch website, a lawsuit alleging repeated sex abuse in immigrant detention centers. On this show, you've heard about the Tacoma Immigration Detention Center, for example, and other detention centers. It appears that these are becoming the new Indian schools. The BIA notorious Indian relocation program, where largely churches, but also government contractors, were put in charge of brainwashing, removing any trace of culture, exploiting, and keeping any evidence of pride in native traditions down in an entire generation of young Indians, young Native Americans in this country. The BIA schools were largely shut down, and the relocation program was shut down due to repeated claims of abuse, cultural, sexual, racial. And it looks like the immigrant detention centers being built, brought to you by Kellogg Brown and Root and Halliburton, are following in that very same pattern. Of course, it's no accident. Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM. I want to play another Roots track for you. And then we're going to be joined on the phone by Catherine Redmond, who is the director of the National Coalition Against Violent Athletes. Stay tuned. Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM and freakradio.org.
Just lost and they want direction, but they don't get the police, they get the protection. Rogers in the Bonneville. It's kind of a thrill. My mind will spill. My nana will kill. Of course, bro, like crossbow. I bring the force, though. Hitting your gut, splitting your torso. It's colder than the North Pole. Living the lawful. I'm giving you a jaw full of something awful. Yo, my theoretic is let it become a setting. This shit bag will leave you diabetic. For paramedics, I spit flames and get dames to get change. Whip it, bull bark and lock the shop. Don't bother me, y'all. Don't you dare lie to me, y'all. I don't know who this nigga that you try to be, y'all. Benefit of doubt, have me think you in it for clout. Big shit, send it for route, we'll finish him out. Joints tip for rigor mortis while we swimming in waters. Women with daughters, we'll have us niggas send them with orders.
This thing of music, turn it up, let it not, let it bang on the block. Tell the neighbors, call the cops. The cops gon' come, but they ain't gon' do shit. They don't want no problems, when they gon' stupid. All in the music, all in the music. All in the music, all in the music. All in the music, all in the music. All in the music. It's in the music, turn it up, let it not, let it bang on the block. Tell the neighbors, call the cops. The cops gon' come, but they ain't
gon' do shit. Free Radio 101.1 FM. One more story from Migra Watch. Again, MigraWatch.org. Labor complaints point to human rights abuses at Lakeside Organics. Migra Watch is publicizing some of the public complaints made against the Watsonville-based Lakeside Organics Corporation. These complaints point to systemic human rights abuses by the Lakeside Organics Corporation and serve as a reminder that organic certification often does not take into consideration abusive labor conditions. Complaints include employees work overtime without compensation. Keep in mind that the normal workday for overtime, without overtime for agricultural workers, is 10 hours. Sexual and discriminatory harassment complaints, being ignored by supervisors. Unsafe working conditions where employees developed rashes from fertilizers being applied to produce. Making employees drink non-potable water from the hose. Overflowing porta-potties, which were not cleaned at regular intervals. Supervisors drinking on the job, verbally abusing and dehumanizing workers. Claims of lack of medical compensation for job-related injuries and dumping injured workers were also made. These complaints were issued in the fall of 2007. Long, drawn-out legal efforts to hold Lakeside Organics accountable for their labor abuses have simply highlighted the discrepancy of legal resources to the labors of the corporations. Traditional legal support systems for migrant laborers, such as CRLA, have been systematically targeted by corporate interests that the government has come to represent. Originally funded via the Community Service Agency, it was substantially defunded during the Reagan administration. During the Clinton administration, it was heavily restricted when Republican lawmakers inserted provisions preventing representation of undocumented immigrants and preventing legal aid from collecting attorney's fees. Over the past few years, CRLA has been investigated numerous times for alleged noncompliance with federal funding restrictions, making it difficult for federally funded legal agencies such as CRLA to offer meaningful help in cases where some of the persons making claims may be out of status. Here in California, Governor Schwarzenegger has been reforming labor law to better serve business interests, making legal support very difficult to obtain. Additionally, there's a growing threat caused by collusion of corporations, immigrant enforcement, and the shifting regulations regarding ICE inspecting employee complaints, which has led to a chilling effect on the ability of laborers to assert any rights at all. The robbing, abuse, and violation of basic human dignity is resold as feel-good local organic produce. Our only recourse is intercommunity communication. Critical to the sustainable existence is meaningful connection to the production of the food that sustains us. All people are encouraged to check their organics and make meaningful connections to the people that produce what we rely on to survive. It is not enough to simply buy local or buy organic. We must include a deep consideration of the means of production and our aesthetics of consumption. Without an aim of mutual sustainable existence for all members of our community, we ensure a lack of sustainable existence for everyone in the near future. This is from MigraWatch.org. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM. We're going to hear another song. This is a band from San Francisco called Death to Anders. It's the track. I can't find the track. It's the Man of a Thousand Regrets on Free Radio, 101.1 FM.
Thank you. Tuesday, District Attorney Michael Schrunk, responding to an open letter from the Police Accountability Organization, Portland Cop Watch, cited insufficient evidence in declining to indict a corrections officer in relation to a 2005 beating of an inmate. At issue is inmate David Baker's allegation of an unprovoked attack by Officer David Thompson and Thompson's online posting in which he bragged about the incident, quote, "I crushed a dude's eye socket from repeatedly punching him in it. Then I charged him with menacing and harassment. He took a plea to get away from me," unquote. Schrunk claims his office reviewed the investigation and possible charges before concluding there was insufficient evidence. The DA considers Baker a convicted criminal who declined to take a polygraph, an unreliable witness, despite his renewed assertion that Officer Thompson assaulted him without provocation. Schrunk says Baker is willing to drop the issue, saying he just wants to go on with his life. Schrunk also quotes a prosecution decline memorandum that Senior Deputy District Attorney Don Reese allegedly wrote, characterizing Thompson's online boasting as the exaggerations made during a role-playing game. Reese further maintains Baker's eye socket was bruised, not crushed, during the incident. Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch characterizes Schrunk's response as, quote, "evidence that his office is unwilling to prosecute officers for on-duty uses of force," unquote. Handelman suggests that Portland retain an independent prosecutor for cases in which law enforcement officers are accused of violent crimes. In the meantime, the organization awaits the outcome of pending internal affairs and Department of Public Safety standards and training investigations. This has been Jacob Anderson Mitchell reporting for KABU Radio.
Again, that story comes from KABU in Portland, a story about yet another acquittal of a police officer in a case of police brutality that he was, in fact, bragging about. On a related topic, but somewhat outside of the realm of law enforcement, on the phone on the Indy Newswire is Kathy Redmond. She's the founder of an organization called the National Coalition Against Violent Athletes, here to talk about the De Anza rape case, as we've been discussing on the show, and other cases of violence committed by athletes, college and otherwise, in the United States. Kathy, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Welcome, and thank you for calling in to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi, thank you.
Absolutely. If we could start by giving a baseline summary for some folks who haven't heard the story of the case over the hill in De Anza. It's a particularly disturbing case, but if you wouldn't mind telling some of the details.
Sure. The case at De Anza involved an underage young woman, an underage girl who is under the age of consent, under the drinking age also. And basically, some members of the De Anza baseball team had her in a room, and she was drunk, very drunk, practically passed out. She had vomited all over herself, and the guys were taking turns with her in the bedroom. Obviously, she couldn't consent. Three female soccer players had overheard that the guys had a girl in the room and were taking turns. The girls tried to get in. They couldn't get in. They were blocked from entering the bedroom. The three girls then barged in, saw the girl with vomit all over her face, saw the guys taking turns raping her. She was unconscious, per their statement. She was unconscious. They carried her out of the building that they were in, and I took her to the hospital. I guess 4 hours later, they did toxicology work on her. And basically what we're looking at now is the DA's office decided, first of all, not to prosecute. When they had the grand jury hearing, they did not have the three eyewitnesses. They did not have the three eyewitnesses come in and testify to anything. They were not invited to testify before the grand jury. The DA then sent this to the Attorney General's office, and now the Attorney General's office has said that they won't further investigate, that there's still not enough evidence. And so basically what you have right now is the fact that a gang rape of an underage, unable to consent, unwilling rape victim, basically, if that happens to you, they're not going to prosecute. So, and of course, none of the De Anza baseball team, nobody from that team will talk. Nobody from that team will finger who specifically the men were that were doing it. And at the time, the three girls, their only objective was to get the woman out of the situation and to the hospital.
There's a number of, again, extremely disturbing elements of this, but in terms of the question of consent, there some of the media reports that I've read and seen with regards to this site, number one, like you said, a lack of evidence, and number two, even people who are involved or attempting to prosecute here say that it's uncertain whether a crime was committed, whether something bad happened, but the definition of what is a crime and what is not seems to be in question, where, as you mentioned with the word consent, on three different strikes here, three different possibilities, there was absolutely no consent given and something went down, yes?
Right. Oh, exactly. The mere fact, number one, the mere fact that she was drunk, I believe, I'm trying to remember what her blood alcohol was, and it was she was legally drunk, and when the toxicology tests were taken, when the blood alcohol tests were taken, it was 4 hours later, 4 hours after they had brought her in.
Hmm.
So she was incapacitated. And the men said, well, we heard groans. Yeah, people in comas can groan also. That that doesn't matter. But the issue here also is the fact that she was underage. She is not the age of consent for sexual activity at all in California at the time that this happened. The issue, though, that the AG's office is trying to put forth is the fact that as for identifying the men who did it, that's what it has become difficult. That's where the problem is. However, she's filed a civil suit. Maybe she will be able to get to the bottom of it through a civil suit. That doesn't mean that the AG's office should totally close this case, because some things can come out in the civil suit that could change the nature of the criminal case. I'd like to see that happen. But yeah, so obviously something horrible happened. The sheriff in Santa Clara County said that they will continue to investigate, that people got away with rape is what her quote was. And I definitely agree with her. I mean, I wholeheartedly agree with her. And especially, you don't have gang rapes where you have three eyewitnesses to it. And they were sober also.
Now, that's the question that makes this this is an especially extraordinary case because of that. Now, you mentioned that they hadn't been invited. They haven't testified. Their testimony hasn't factored into this case.
When the DA first put this before a grand jury and she decided not to press charges, the Santa Clara DA.
The survivor, the DA.
Right.
Okay.
Right. The three eyewitnesses were not invited to render testimony to the grand jury.
How is that possible? I know you probably don't know the answer. How is that possible?
I do not have an answer for that at all. No way, no how. I do not have an answer for that. Normally, when you have a grand jury case, you put everybody up there because you strongly believe in your case, because the evidence is there, because you want everybody, the grand jurors, to see what the evidence is and to reach a verdict of proceed and charge or drop it or dismiss it. Something like that where the three eyewitnesses, I mean, you can't have a bank robbery and have three eyewitnesses not go into a grand jury hearing. I mean, how do you do that? But in this case, those three women were not invited.
So these three women haven't testified.
And they were the sober ones.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the men said, and there's been this question of what, who did testify, what some of these men have said, and who was granted immunity.
I don't know that. Don't know any of that.
But there's, I mean, these, in other words, the proceedings haven't entirely been transparent.
No.
And,
no, not
and
at all.
There have been some of the men in that room have given testimony.
Right. Like,
but it hasn't come out.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Do you know how many men or what the questions of,
I don't
immunity
know.
Hinged on?
I don't know. I believe that that grand jury, if I'm not mistaken, and I could be, but if I'm not mistaken, I believe that was a very closed grand jury. Most grand juries are very closed. So I don't think anything came out from that. The reason that we know that the three eyewitnesses weren't invited in was because they've said so. They were not on the witness list. So I don't, from the men's perspective, from other perspectives of people there, people who may have testified, I don't know. I don't know what was said, but this certainly, like I said, when the civil suit comes around, when the depositions start with regard to that, we will have a lot more information about that. We will have, because the men will have to be deposed. You may have some men who decide that they will talk and implicate somebody else, because from what I understand, most of them are no longer at De Anza. So you might have some guys that say, I resent being implicated in this, and I no longer have any ties to these guys, so I'm going to say something. So that could end up happening. I would love to see that happen.
So in the civil suit then that is ongoing, there's a chance that some of these men will be subpoenaed. There's a chance that these three eyewitnesses will be able to give their stories and testify.
Absolutely.
But the criminal proceeding is the one that's been closed.
Right.
De facto closed, right. Or like officially, is it over and done with?
I don't know. This case has been one of the harder cases to really even follow, just because of how very quiet everything has been. I know that the victim was, when she had talked to the DA's office or to the AG's office there, that she was somewhat satisfied with the interview, with what they were doing. She had no complaints about the AG's office at all. But that doesn't mean that any of us really know what transpired at the AG's office either. So, you know, you get into cases like this, a lot of it is murky until you get to the civil part of it. Because in criminal law, the laws are so very different. And whereas in civil cases, everything is based on a preponderance of the evidence, very little is sealed, people have access to the depositions, to the transcripts of the depositions, and there, that's where things start unfolding and you kind of get an aha feeling about a case. But something like this, when you actually have the victim who was so unconscious that she doesn't remember. So now the person who actually went through it, and frankly, from a psychological standpoint, she's better off not having remembered. Had she remembered the details of stuff like this, and it doesn't mean that she won't later on, but right now she has no recollection at all, and that is, I think, helping her to move on with her life. I think the more traumatized people are the three that rescued her.
Those three have been... In terms of this case being quiet or difficult to follow, those three have been extremely vocal. Those three have been giving interviews, have been
right.
Keeping this story alive.
And they're three very courageous women, and I very much commend them for that. I truly do. I commend them for speaking out. Unfortunately, they might be giving defense attorneys for the other guys a little too much fodder, but. In the case of making people aware of this, keeping this on the radar, because people's attention spans are very short, for them to have been able to do all that they have done, to say everything, to keep working at it, and I know that a couple of groups are wanting to have a conference at De Anza about how to address this kind of behavior, how to put together a policy, to basically educate, to figure out what do we need to do to keep this from happening. Because you can have civil suits, you can have closed criminal cases, but the bottom line is, what do we need to do to stop this from happening? Why does this keep going? What is De Anza doing? Where are they bringing their baseball players in from? Do they know the background of their baseball players? There was a question about some of the coaches or assistant coaches and having connections to certain professional teams. And, you know, a lot of stuff needs to come out in order to get a handle on exactly what happened and what can be done about it. You know, frankly, I'm still outraged at the DA's office, because what people need to look at is, and what people need to truly consider is, one, something very bad happened. Something that is a war crime happened there by the De Anza baseball players. We all know that. Everybody knows that. But the message out there is, if all of the guys don't talk, and if there are too many guys to finger, if you're in a dark room, basically there will be no justice for that. We will not proceed with anything. We will not be involved, and the victim remains a victim, and that's it. There is no justice for that. And that's really the core element here is, when you look at what have we learned from this very bad situation, we've learned that in a gang rape environment, you can get away with it. And to me, that's the worst thing to learn. And that's something that a lot of, unfortunately, in the work that I do, that a lot of college athletes have learned. That if you stick together, if you come up with the same stories, if you don't talk to the police, if you get the defense attorney in early on, and this is my initial issue with Duke, no matter how Duke transpired, how that turned out, the mere fact that the 40 guys said nothing. Something happened, and they said nothing. So years and years of legal maneuvering goes on, or months and months, I should say. The town is almost in a riot situation, and you've got members of a lacrosse team saying nothing. And they were there, and they know what transpired. And this is exactly what you have again in the case of De Anza. You've got a bunch of boys who wanted to be men, who thought that raping a woman or attempting to rape a woman or whatever was manly. And then when they're called to accountability, they know nothing, they saw nothing, and it goes away.
So taking
that's the problem.
Taking both that case, the Duke lacrosse case, and the De Anza case as case studies, as examples, how far does this reach? Is it how much is this an issue on college campuses nationwide?
This is a very big issue on college campuses nationwide, and I had talked to a CNN reporter recently who was looking at shootings on campus, and I said, instead of looking at shootings, which I understand, I mean, murder and shootings are a huge ordeal, huge safety issue, the fact that not more is not done on college campuses about rape and gang rape, really, for somebody like me, is a slap in the face, because 1 in 4 college women will be raped. Those are the statistics. And yet, how often do we have a college shooting? I understand they're devastating. I understand people are killed. But people need to understand what the extent of rape is and what it does, how it affects somebody. And so... So this being so pervasive and dealing with young women fresh out of their homes, going into a college campus where they're not taught what rape is, what rape does, where the men have already learned that rape is okay. They don't call it rape, but it's a boys will be boys attitude. that's what needs to be addressed. That's what needs to be dealt with. And the thing that's most scary to me is you see a lot of the high school athletes doing the same thing. And you see a lot of the high school athletes videotaping things like this. And so, and again, with no accountability. With no accountability. The schools don't want to get in trouble. They don't want to get sued. So the schools don't deal with it. So it basically becomes, for a victim, you're going to take on this monolith. You're going to take on the school, the athletes, whomever. Because there's nobody to stand up for that victim.
So there's a boys will be boys attitude for high school athletes, for college. They're at least students. And this extends to professional athletes, the adult world. This extends to this culture of silence continues throughout.
Sure.
Your organization focuses specifically on athletes. Can you talk about professional athletics as well?
Professional athletes have, of course, they're going to have more power. But at the same time, professional athletes, in my opinion, with the work that I've done so far, they're not as inclined to engage in the behaviors of college athletes. College athletes are much more immature. They don't see it. They don't see themselves as having a lot to lose. They don't see themselves as getting caught. They see themselves as more invincible. They see more of the entitlement, which is probably the problem with professional basketball, because with college football, you move into the pros, you have to stop at college first. You have to go to college first. In professional basketball, you don't. So you're pulling very immature kids who would probably learn quite a bit in college, and you're pulling them directly into the NBA. And there is a maturity issue there. I think that as you get into the professional ranks, like I said, you have a lot more power. You have a lot more money, you have a lot more entitlement, but you have some level of maturity there. You have some level of oversight. You realize that there are sports writers that might not like you. When you're in college, when you look at where college campuses are, when you look at the big schools, and you look at Columbus, Ohio, South Bend, Indiana, Lincoln, Nebraska, Norman, Oklahoma, Columbia, Missouri, you're dealing with a town in an environment that's very sheltered, that depends on that school, on that team for basically their economic structure. So the sports writers aren't going to be so heavily critical in that area. And they're much more coddled in that environment than a professional environment. And so that's why a lot of times what you have is the guys that don't move on to the pros in from college, that once they're out of college and they don't have their degree, like many of them don't, they don't have their degree, they get into trouble because nobody is there to protect them anymore. And people can't figure out why. And that's exactly the reason. Once you're used up in college, they're not there for you anymore. And that's what I try to get these athletes to understand, is that in college, they're commodities, and what they take out of college depends on them. Because the coaches, everybody else, are going to make sure their academics are handled, they're going to make sure that their papers are written, they're going to make sure that the professors are greased, basically. And when they get into trouble, they're going to make sure that the DA is called, that the police are dealt with. They have a huge system of protection around them that they don't necessarily have as much of in the pros, although it is there. It's just a very different environment.
So then these athletes are being supported by administration structures, by coaches for the for that direction of them as a commodity that, and something that's marketable, something that's profitable.
Absolutely, and that's what I try to... And that's when I talk to the athletes, because I truly care about the athletes. I come from a sports-oriented family. I'm an athlete myself. And I care how they're used. I care about what they're learning. I care about the life skills that they're learning and what they're applying. Because otherwise, these guys, many of them, based on what they've learned in high school and college sports, many of them are set up to get into trouble, period.
So then what's being done to combat this? Your organization and others are working. We hear what's going wrong and who we're up against. What's being done in order to, you mentioned the conference at De Anza, what's being done in order to combat this pattern, this pervasive, wall of silence?
If schools aren't being proactive about it, then they're obviously going to have to be reactive, because Title IX is becoming a great equalizer in this. Arizona State University right now has a Title IX suit against them brought by the same group of attorneys that sued CU. And it is a much more disturbing outcome, basically, of administrators shredding documents, shredding evidence of a rape that occurred by somebody that had numerous infractions with the school and was even expelled. And I believe he's actually from California. Hmm. And so you have the Title IX lawsuits, and then that forces schools to come up with a policy and to address it. Most schools are going to kick and scream against policies about this, about rape. At CU, for instance, when the athletes were being going through life skills to talk about nutrition and proper hydration, they brought in Gatorade representatives to talk about gambling. They brought in former people from the mob they brought in financial analysts with, you know, finances. But when they got to the rape part, the coach read, Coach Barnett, read from the student-athlete handbook and said, I expect you all to treat women like you treat my daughter. And that was the extent of it. And that's more of the attitude that we see. University of Louisville, I was brought in there. They were very proactive about it. And it depends on your athletic director. And it really, the athletes know when a school has zero tolerance. The athletes know when a school is serious about rape and sexual assault. Most schools are not. And so what we do is we try to educate the athletes where the schools allow us to go in. When it comes to professional athletes, they have many more programs, but their time is limited, and it depends on the individual franchise, the individual teams. So you might have a player development person in New England, for instance, who is very proactive, who wants to deal with this, and you might have somebody, let's say, in Oakland, a player development person who is told by the owner or the management, that's not an issue we want to deal with. So the NFL is trying to overhaul it and to convince these teams to do it, but it's difficult even for them. But I do know the NFL is taking some pretty proactive strides. I like where they're going. They have a long way to go, don't get me wrong. I like where they're going. The NBA really does very little, very little. It just depends on who wants to be proactive and who brings us in. And in the meantime, if they have to be reactive and that's how you bring about change, then so be it.
So from start to finish, I mean, we can call it what it is, rape culture, in the educational system. There's a look the other way attitude. Then there's a cover up and support, and if caught, then there's a slap on the wrist attitude. Mm-hmm. For some of these schools that are taking proactive policy steps or any kinds of steps to actually confront rape culture, what are some examples? What does that look like at a junior college or at a state university?
When they have a solid policy about it, when they have education about it, when it's not just built into violence or built into something else, when you actually go through and are able to talk to the athletes, both men and women, about, because women can be some of the worst enemies of other women, of other victims who come forward about being raped. Women can be worse than any man. That's what it looks like, is when you have policies, when you bring people in, when you educate, when you have zero tolerance. She said this, he said this, you know, boys will be boys. At some point, and I understand justice, and I understand, you know, you never want anybody to be falsely accused. You always have to guard for that. But at some point, when this pendulum swings as it does so often in favor of the athlete, it's got to swing the other way in order to have some kind of equilibrium, in order to have some kind of balance. And I hate that I have to say that, but I see all the time so many women affected by this. And in fact, your listenership, if they have a chance to go online and go to, I believe it was the Seattle Times, and this is very important for California to know. University of Washington, during the time of Rick Neuheisel, who just got hired on by UCLA, the University of Washington had four Title IX suits filed against them. Barbara Hedges was the female athletic director, one of the few in the country. She turned a blind eye to all of this. I even met with her, and it was a very tense meeting because of all that was happening. And even the women's groups on campus at the University of Washington turned a blind eye to it, because when they were interviewed, they said, well, the sports makes money for our school so that I don't have to pay more tuition, which is reprehensible. But in the Seattle Times, they did a series, a three-part, I believe, investigative series spanning 6 years, and all the things that happened to people by the University of Washington football team, by even some guys that are now in the pros, that was all smoothed over. And I think the DA in King County at the time, he still might be the DA, is a Washington booster. And it highlighted all the stuff that happened, and it's very disturbing. And just so people know, a lot of this stuff didn't come out at the time. There were a lot of girls, a lot of women, a lot of people afraid. And the University of Washington was very antagonistic and very hostile to anybody who made these reports. So if you read about it, it is staggering. But it's something that it's not just at the University of Washington, and it's something that really affects the amount of concern that I have that UCLA would bring somebody like Rick Neuheisel into the school.
Now, I just looked at SeattleTimes.com and just searched Title IX, and that whole series comes up.
Mm-hmm.
So folks are more than welcome to go there, SeattleTimes.com, and check out that series over several years.
Yeah, wonderful.
Wanted to ask you to briefly explain, if you would, just a little more detail. You said that women can be worse than any man.
Right.
As in some of these cases. I'd like to ask you to explain that a little bit.
Men, for the most part, cannot fathom what a woman would go through when she's raped. Men cannot fathom that. Men start thinking of their sisters, their friends. Men are much more apt to believe the woman than the women are. Because here's the situation. If you have a jury of women, which, incidentally, that's probably the worst jury you would want if you're a rape victim. If you have a jury of women, in order to make themselves feel more secure, in the interest of self-preservation, they are going to believe that the woman did something to warrant being raped or to warrant being attacked or to warrant a, quote, miscommunication. That way, they can justify their own safety. They can say that it's never going to happen to them. Because obviously it was under this other woman's control, and she screwed up. So if a woman blames the victim, in her own mind, that's building security for her. That's saying that it's never going to happen to me, that these random acts don't just happen. Because for a woman to think that when she steps out of her car, or when she goes onto a campus, or when she goes into a classroom, for her to think that she could be harmed just by doing that is very scary. And then you also have just women being very, in and of themselves, being very critical of other women. Men are not that way. Men can, I think men appeal to a woman's, the emotional level of women. So, and again, men cannot fathom. Men sit there and think, if they're in a jury pool, I know what this guy was thinking. Men can understand what that guy was thinking and can basically say, Yeah, I know where he was going with this. I know what his intention was. And if he ever did that to my sister or my mother or my wife, yeah, no way. So it's very different. It's a very different phenomenon. And that's something that I think was true with the OJ case, that was true, you know, Pamela Mackey with the Kobe Bryant case. Women can be very hostile towards other women, more so than what men can be.
In terms of gendered responses to sexual assault and to rape culture, one of the things that I've noticed is that men and women both, but especially men, immediately jump, as you mentioned the pendulum analogy, immediately jump to the false accusation or the exception or the what if it happens to us or that it's extremely common. If you ask a group of men about rape, that's like on half of the minds.
Right.
On the homepage of the website, which is ncava.org, National Coalition Against Violent Athletes, there's a statistic from the FBI that says more people falsely report their own death than file a false report alleging sexual assault.
Right.
Again, that idea is out there constantly in mainstream media, in discussions that I've personally had, but there's always this knee-jerk response that there are these false accusations,
mm-hmm.
And that people are falsely accused. And in all of the cases that you've mentioned with regards to athletes, this is a common response. How do we address that?
Sure. First of all, it's a very scary to think that somebody can level an accusation against you and you have to defend yourself and pay a ton of attorney's costs and try to avoid jail. I mean, that's a very scary thought. My initial reaction to that is simply this. In a justice system gone right, when all things are considered, the amount of evidence needed, as we see with Bienza, the amount of evidence needed to warrant an actual charge of rape is ridiculous. It is a high, high level. Somebody might come in and make a false report. They could. But in order to get a charge from that, in order to actually end up going to trial over that or having a plea bargain over that, the evidence is ridiculous. The DA has to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, which means, like in the case of Bienza, is that the guy that raped you? I don't know. I'm not sure. This person said, could it be that this guy didn't rape you, but somebody next to him did? There's reasonable doubt. It's for rape, it's ridiculous. For a victim going forward with something like that, the pressure on her, when you look at Kobe Bryant had a history, a long sexual history. He also, from what I was told, had some other issues in his past where other women alleged that he raped them. Now, those women didn't do anything. This woman had her entire sexual history put out there for the general public consumption all over the world. Did Kobe's? Not a chance. Because that's seen as prejudicial. The victim, you can smear the victim all you want. That's not prejudicial. But if you bring in a past history of somebody, of the defendant, of the accused, that's prejudicial. So you can have a child molester, you can have a repeat sex offender go in on a charge of rape, and you cannot bring up that they've had priors because that's seen as prejudicial. Now, the rape victim, you can put every boyfriend she's ever had on the stand and anybody that holds a grudge against her. So when you look at that, when you look at that scenario, and you look at the fact that rape victims are very afraid to come forward, even if, let's say that somebody wants to make a vindictive accusation, they can be charged with false reporting, they can be sued for attorney's fees, and with rape, it's very difficult to prove. So really, when a woman alleges rape or a person alleges rape, I'll say a man also, when they allege rape, the standards are set so high because they could actually end up being hurt more than the person that they're accusing.
In this justice system gone right, what kind of models for restorative justice, or what kind of models for the simple word justice brings up a pretty wide variety of responses and ideas.
Sure.
What does the coalition, or what does your organization, or what do you look to as examples of how justice can be found in some of these cases?
Oh, gosh. How justice can be found. That's really difficult. There isn't a case out there now where I can point to it and say, that is a justice system. That's what it should look like. Especially not in the area that I'm in. I haven't seen that. What I do see a lot of is people with chance after chance after chance after chance at reform, where their sentences are lenient, where they plea bargain, and they go out and they commit the same thing. That's what I see a lot of. And I tell you, I'm not sure that I can really point you to an example of what justice is in this realm. I know that there, you know, even with the CU case, none of those guys were charged with anything. CU did end up changing, and they had to bring on a Title IX, somebody to oversee their Title IX program so that they didn't get in trouble with it anymore. They revised their student-athlete handbook and their policies. I think that's probably about as close to justice as you can get in this area. But what she had to go through in order to get that and basically do it on her own was unbelievable. So, I mean, that's a really tough question for me, because you would love to see, of course, we have DNA evidence right now. The only way truly to bring about justice in something like this is to make sure that every woman out there, that every girl out there, that every guy out there knows exactly what the legal definition of rape is. Because I truly believe you have guys out there that have raped multiple times, and they could take a lie detector test and pass it because they don't believe that they raped anybody, because they don't know. That's when it becomes very hazy, is when you have, you know, kids having sex younger and younger and younger, and they don't have the capacity to understand what rape is. So what you've done is you've trained a rapist, and you've trained a rape victim. And if you watch it on the media, if you watch stuff on TV, what they characterize as rape is very brutal. And it usually leads to murder or beating or something like that. Not the regular standard of what we know to be rape, being, I said no, he didn't listen, he kept doing it, I said no, he said shut up, and he raped me. That's more along the lines of what a normal rape is. So I'm not, for us to see justice with regard to that in this day and age right now, it would take so much. And like I said, with DNA evidence, you can go into a rape crisis center and have a rape kit done, and those are pretty good. But most victims don't know enough that they've been raped to do that.
We're talking with Kathy Redmond, the founder of the National Coalition Against Violent Athletes. 1 year ago, there was a press conference in front of the Santa Clara County DA's office. And Carol Garvey, a president of Dawn, read a statement that I want to close with and finish with. She pleaded with the boys who were in the room to come forward. And she said, "They're hiding behind you, the witnesses, hoping that the jock code of silence holds and that they won't be found out for the cowards that they are, even while tarnishing your good name. I call you who witnessed the event boys, because that is what you are. Real men would come forward and name the perpetrators. If the perpetrators are allowed to go free, they will keep that sense of entitlement and be free to rape again. The girls and women you love will not be safe. Your unborn daughters will not be safe.
I know that may sound funny to you, but when I was raped 34 years ago, the man was old enough to be my father. After he raped me and I was crying hysterically, he tried to calm me by saying, I never meant to hurt you, I thought you wanted it, and I have a daughter your age. So I ask you boys to examine your heart, the kind of people you are, and the kind of people you want to be, and for your family, and for your college, which is also my alma mater, and for your community, and most of all for yourselves. Do the right thing and report the perpetrators. We'll all be better for it, and your good name will not be scarred forever for a crime you didn't commit. She read that on the steps of the window in front of the DA's office, and a year later, you've given a pretty clear indictment of what this justice system has to offer survivors of rape and sexual assault. I want to thank you very much for your time and for your work.
Thank you.
And give you an opportunity to give any final words.
Well, I just wanted to say I was there when she read that, and it was extremely moving, and it was very powerful. And I want to thank the people that have stood with us in this whole case and has watched this unravel to our horror, and who have kept this going, because this victim certainly deserves better. She's doing well. She is in college. She is playing softball, and, you know, it's boosting her confidence. But I think that the more support that she knows she has, the more support that there is in the community for some kind of reform, and the more that the community knows that this is not going away, then that will begin the change. That will be the change that we want to start seeing.
Kathy, thank you very much again for calling in and talking with us.
Thank you.
And again, contact information for the organization?
People can go to www.ncava.org. They can also call at 720-963-0373, or they can reach me at skredmond@ncava.org.
Catherine, thank you very much, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks, you too.
Thank you. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, and www.freakradio.org. This is the Indie Newswire show. Again, that was Catherine Redmond, who started the National Coalition Against Violent Athletes in 1997.